From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek, Dan Raviv, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A U.S. airstrike in Iraq killed a top Iranian military official in a major escalation of the conflict between Iran and the U.S. in Iraq. As the new year begins, the impeachment of U.S. President Donald J. Trump is casting a long shadow over U.S. politics as new information emerges about the withholding of funds to Ukraine by the Trump administration, and the parties continue to wrangle over the timing and the rules of the upcoming trial. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un had given a deadline of the end of 2019 for the U.S. to return to the negotiating table for denuclearization talks. That deadline has passed, with no clear path for the resumption of negotiations. And a rash of hate crimes in New York and a deadly church shooting in Texas has government officials and citizens searching for the reasons for the rise in crimes against people of faith. Gentlemen, Happy New Year. Good to see you both again.
Doesn't feel so happy, but hi.
Yeah, it's a, I guess, a perfunctory statement to say Happy New Year. Maybe a wishful thought. I want to dive into this and probably stay with this as long as we can, the U.S. airstrike, because I believe that we have the perfect panel to go into this issue. According to the Pentagon, after Iranian-based militias had withdrawn from the U.S. embassy, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered an airstrike at Baghdad International Airport that killed Qasem Soleimani, a key Iranian military commander, in a, quote, decisive defensive action to protect U.S. personnel abroad that was intended to deter future Iranian attack plans. Again, this is according to the Pentagon. Dan, I want to start with you. For those who may not be familiar, this is a towering figure over the last 20, 30 years in the Middle East. But could you give us a brief bio on who is this man, Qasem Soleimani?
Qasem Soleimani kept popping up all over the Middle East, wherever Iran was somehow involved with local militia units, with groups that certainly the United States called terrorist groups. Soleimani was an avowed enemy of Israel. He clearly was trying to weaken the U.S. As a matter of fact, when you speak to people at the Department of Defense here in Washington, for years now, they said that Soleimani was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Because in Iraq, after the U.S. invaded that country, which is now almost 17 years ago, a lot of the attacks on American soldiers, including those bombs, the IEDs that are left at the side of highways, were blamed on Soleimani and his militias. So he was an Iranian who was sent overseas, or after years would start sending himself, and we'd see press coverage in countries like Lebanon and then Syria during the years of the civil war there, and obviously he was coordinating what Iran was doing. So from a U.S. and Israeli government point of view, Soleimani was one of the most dangerous people in the Middle East. He was head of what's called the Quds Force. Quds is Arabic for the holy, meaning Jerusalem. So the Quds Force, which was really the strike force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran. And so he was considered an Iranian government official involved in all sorts of covert plots.
Jonathan, again, more about Soleimani.
Yeah, I think one of the most important things to realize about Soleimani was that as the head of the Quds Force, I mean, if you want to define the Quds Force to something comparable in the United States, it would be like our special forces. And the Quds Force was also part of the Revolutionary Guards, which is separate from the Iranian army. It's a more ideological military force, which was created to protect and perpetuate the Iranian Islamic Revolution. The significance of Soleimani is that he extended Iran's influence throughout the Middle East by creating and then cultivating militias in Arab countries, primarily among the Shia communities in those countries. I mean, Iran is a Shia country, but most of the Arab world is Sunni. However, in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and in parts of Yemen, the people there are Shia or an offshoot of Shia. For example, in Syria, the ruling family, the Assad family, the Alawites, which is an offshoot of Shia Islam. In Yemen, they're what they call Zaydi, another offshoot.
But all this is to say, this is the connection between.
Exactly. And he was able to build on those cultural and religious connections to develop militias that were loyal to Iran and were much more Shia than they were, let's say, Lebanese or Yemeni or Iraqi.
So they became kind of international strike forces. And I think that was seen during these years of the Syrian civil war, right? There would be mostly Shiite Islamic fighters, even from other countries. And Soleimani seemed to have a big hand in coordinating that and thus supporting Bashar al-Assad's government in Syria.
Exactly.
That's probably in large part why Assad has survived the civil war.
It's totally why he survived.
So I mean,
they intervened in great numbers. They brought over Shia from Afghanistan, Shia from Pakistan. I mean, this was a very large operation that Soleimani ran.
So I think unanimously there's thought that this was a quote-unquote bad guy. Who was responsible for the death of many, many Americans.
But even that's taking a point of view, right? From a U.S. government or a U.S. point of view, he was a bad guy.
And so, And that's what I'm speaking from the U.S. point of view.
And many reporters were saying that in the hours after he died. Okay, let's all agree he's a bad guy. But did President Trump do the right thing by ordering an assassination, especially in the capital of Iraq, and upsetting Iraqi-U.S. relations? But a bad guy, again, if you see the Middle East as being at war in a boiling and constant way, then Soleimani was a very effective soldier for the Islamic Revolutionary Government of Iran.
Well, he was a hero in Iran. So he is thought of as a hero.
Yes.
I think there's 3 days of mourning that have been declared in Iran because of his death.
He was very close to Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader.
He is revered. The U.S. is saying, as I say, unanimously within the United States government, they're saying that this was called a mission of opportunity, is what they're calling it. Why now, I guess, is my question. Because what you've positioned is a guy who's been an operative in the Middle East and doing these sorts of things, whether you classify them as good or bad.
For more than 20 years.
For decades.
Yeah.
Why now?
Okay, so he took over the Quds Force in 1999. So he's been doing this for 20 years. In recent years, he has taunted the United States. He has appeared publicly. He takes lots of selfies of himself as he goes through Syria and Lebanon and Iraq. He sent messages to David Petraeus, who was the commander of U.S. troops in the Middle East for a while, basically saying, I hope you're enjoying this brief period, this brief respite, because things are going to get much tougher for you. Now, the United States and Israel, by the way, had ample opportunities, many opportunities to kill him, but they never did. Why? Because the fear of what would come next, because of this man's stature inside Iran and within the Arab world, in the Shia communities, all these proxy militias that he has created and operated in various countries. He is so revered that the feeling was that we don't know what's going to happen if we kill this guy. Now, Trump decided to pull the trigger. Pompeo, you mentioned
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
Pompeo said there was going to be an imminent attack on American diplomats and troops in the
Which
Middle
may
East.
Well be true, because things were certainly heating up in Baghdad, where there'd been those crowds that assaulted the U.S. embassy in the Green Zone area. And you could imagine that Soleimani would be thinking, what can I do next to weaken the U.S. and get it out of Iraq? So it is credible that Soleimani was planning something. He obviously had just arrived in Baghdad.
Right. But the decision to kill him was Trump's alone, I think.
And interesting that you say that. And let me just reset, because you've mentioned that. It's Trump's decision alone, because Trump has been very reluctant, we would say, to take these sorts of bold steps when it comes to aggression and use of the
Unless military. An American gets killed. When an American gets killed, he acts.
And indeed, just a week before, an American contractor at a base in Iraq was killed by a rocket attack, which the Americans blamed on the pro-Iranian militia. So first, there was a wave of airstrikes on five bases of one of the Hezbollah groups along the Iraq-Syria border on both sides of the border. And then you had this assault on the U.S. embassy. And obviously, President Trump, though on vacation in Florida, well, his patience was running short. I was imagining that the president of the United States didn't know about Soleimani, but got a briefing or two and thinking about what can I do to strike back at Iran without sending 100,000 troops, without going to war. And it probably appealed to him.
Has war been avoided here? Or has war been exacerbated here? That really
anybody who says that they know what's going to happen next is either lying or very, very ignorant. We don't know what's going to happen next. Nobody knows. A Pandora's box basically has been opened, because this man is so revered inside Iran and throughout the Arab world that we really don't know what's going to happen. The way I see it is that it could happen basically in four ways. They could attack American troops and diplomats in Iraq. They could activate Hezbollah in Lebanon and attack an American ally, Israel. They could go after, once again, Saudi oil installations and basically attack the world economy and drive oil prices up and hurt the United States economically. Or they could wait and see. They could, you know, do something in the United States, possibly.
And I'm noting that you don't think there's much chance of a conventional war with the Iranian army, you know, attacking U.S. military units.
No, because they know that any confrontation with the United States is so superior to them in conventional capability that they wouldn't stand a chance.
Hours after the assassination, President Trump on Twitter wrote something that people were trying to figure out, and basically President Trump's message was, Iran does not win at war, but frequently wins in negotiation. I mean, to me, that was Trump suggesting that what Iran should do now is come and talk with us, make a new nuclear deal, and start, well, again, the Trump administration view, start acting like a normal, peaceful country. That's a lot to expect from Iran when you've just done this.
Yes.
Well, you have sanctions, and now you have this. And I think the goal that's been expressed to me from my sources within this administration, spoken or unspoken, is that regime change is kind of the mission of the Trump administration when it comes to Iran. And you may agree and you may not agree, but that's been expressed. And
I felt that behavior change would have been enough for the Trump administration.
Do you think that this gets you behavior change? Or does this move you further away?
The administration is actually divided on this, and that is part of the problem. There are people like Trump who believe he can cut a deal. I mean, he's the deal maker, right? At least he thinks of himself that way. And he thinks that he can cut a deal diplomatically with them. There are others in the administration who want regime change. I think what's important that we need to point out, we sort of have to pull the lens back a little bit here. The assassination of Qasem Soleimani is the culmination of a process that began when Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal.
Exactly.
And he reimposed sanctions, very harsh sanctions.
Exactly.
I mean, Iran economically is really hurting.
Let me stop you right there. Yeah. I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek, Dan Rabib, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Jonathan, I interrupted you. I apologize.
Well, we were saying that this all goes back to the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. And ever since then, there has been growing tension between the United States and Iran, which has expressed itself in the Iranians basically saying, if we can't export our oil, which was the biggest target of U.S. sanctions,
yes,
then nobody else can either.
Right.
So the Iranians started, or at least they were accused of, they deny it, but I think it's pretty clear that they probably did. They harassed shipping in the Persian Gulf. There was an attack on Saudi oil installations. They shot down an American drone, which almost brought us to the brink of war. If you remember, Trump canceled a retaliatory airstrike 10 minutes before it was supposed to go into effect. There has been constant shelling, mortar shelling of American military bases in Iraq. Nobody was killed, but they kept the pressure up.
They did keep
right.
the pressure up.
And when they finally succeeded in killing the American contractor and wounding several American troops, they fired 31 shells. That is not harassment. That is an attempt to kill somebody.
But indeed.
So they were raising the stakes. And then we had the airstrikes that Dan mentioned that killed 25 of the Khatayb Hezbollah in Iraq, the Shia militia, formed and armed and paid for by Qasem Soleimani. and then the attack on the American embassy in Baghdad.
But President Trump could have chosen a lower level response.
Absolutely. Still.
Going after such a prominent figure is absolutely raising the stakes, and then immediately saying, in effect, maybe now you want to negotiate. So I don't expect negotiations to happen, but again, it's the Middle East. You never know. Within a few months, back channel communications could happen. I don't think so.
But first there has to be retaliation.
And I think that's what we're all waiting for, is how
will they?
What form will this retaliation come? The verbal response has been swift and been vehement from the Iranian government.
Stay tuned, everybody.
Yeah. Stay tuned, everyone. Yeah. It's a good way to end that segment. I want to touch on the rest of our subjects as quickly as we can, and as completely as we can. With the time we have remaining, the Trump impeachment, the U.S. Congress is poised to return to Washington after the holiday break, and the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, still has not delivered the articles of impeachment to the Senate. There's wrangling over the procedures that will be used in the trial in the Senate. Will witnesses be called? And there's even concern over if there's any chance at all that anything resembling a, air quotes, fair and impartial trial or procedure in the Senate. Jonathan, I'll start with you. The timing on this, there's much hand-wringing over the timing and the articles not being delivered to the Congress. Is this Nancy Pelosi being political, or is it Nancy Pelosi being practical, or difference?
Well, I think it's mostly political. I think she does. I mean, I know that the Republicans deny this, but she does have some leverage here. She's basically saying, I'm not going to hand over these articles of impeachment to the Senate, which would begin the trial process, until I am assured that the process, the trial itself, and the structure of the trial is going to be fair. The leader of the Republicans in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, has said that he doesn't want any witnesses, or maybe he'll have witnesses, but it's not clear whether there'll be witnesses.
Right.
And the administration is holding back key people who could address some very, very important issues in this impeachment process.
And that speaks to witnesses. Dan, I'll go to you for this one. Did you want to speak on the process, on Pelosi? Because I wanted to get you to weigh in on the witnesses.
Well, I wanted to bring the focus back to the issue, why President Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives on December 18th, and now officially stands trial in the Senate, assuming the trial gets going, and that is how he behaved vis-a-vis Ukraine. For a while, withholding military aid that Congress had approved, and we know on a phone call with Ukraine's President Zelensky that Trump said, I'd like you to do us a favor, and that included investigating Democrats and former Vice President Joe Biden, who right now is running for the White House. And so President Trump says it was a perfect phone call, nothing was wrong, it's all a big fat hoax. Democrats think it's obvious that he committed impeachable offenses, and to the Republicans it's obvious that he did not. So again, we take the same set of facts, totally divisive. What's the point of a Senate trial? I can see why a lot of Democrats would say, hey, he was impeached by the House, where Democrats dominate. The Senate has a Republican majority. What's the point of a trial? And so Nancy Pelosi must figure if she can possibly stop it or have leverage and insist on more witnesses, which will reveal more about Trump's behavior. Hey, he may not be convicted and removed from office, but it would help Democrats politically by making Trump look bad. Things are really bitter, but we've just begun an election year. It's going to be a very bitter year. But as part of the political theater, we probably will have the president on trial. And since Republicans dominate the Senate, I assume it's going to be a short trial. It may or may not have some testimony. And then he'll be not convicted and not removed from office. And the whole rest of the year, candidate for re-election Donald Trump will boast that he beat impeachment.
Well, as the saying goes, by
and
someone,
raise money off of it.
We'll say, not so fast, my friend, in the sense that there is still information that's being revealed. We've had emails from reporting in the New York Times that have revealed direct connections between the withholding of aid and the president personally directing the withholding of that. And it seems like new information is coming out. There was a rather speedy investigation process in the House of Representatives, if more information keeps coming to light. If witnesses say they're going to come forward, as Rudy Giuliani has volunteered to come forward.
That lawyer for Trump, yeah.
Right. But as Dan just said, the Democrats think what he did and the additional evidence that further proves what he did is an impeachable offense. The Republicans don't. Some of them totally acknowledge that, yes, he did this, and it was probably not the wise thing to do, but it doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense.
Let's move over real quickly to North Korea talks. And in his New Year's address, Kim made it clear that he felt there was no grounds for North Korea to be bound by a self-declared moratorium on testing nuclear bombs and intercontinental missiles, ballistic missiles. His statement included, we will steadily develop necessary and prerequisite strategic weapons for the security of the state until the U.S. rolls back its hostile policy towards the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and a lasting and durable peacekeeping mechanism is built. It seemed as though the two countries had a golden opportunity when you had the leaders meeting twice.
Correct.
Three meetings.
President Trump went to the Korean border and stepped into North Korea.
Well, three meetings. You are correct. There seemed to be an opportunity for progress here.
It'll be a big deal if he tests another nuclear weapon or a missile that could potentially reach the U.S. That'll be a big deal.
Yeah.
But is it just an attempt to put some pressure on Trump? Or is it over?
No, I don't think it's over. We can't really declare anything dead. If you look at what Kim said, as you said, he said he was no longer bound by his self-imposed moratorium on testing of missiles and nuclear weapons. But he did not declare that he was going to begin testing. He just said, I'm not bound anymore. And he also didn't declare the end of diplomacy. So this was, I think, a statement that was both defiant, because he's losing patience with the American approach to these talks, but it was also very cautious. He's not closing the door.
I think, by the way, that President Trump's move against the senior Iranian official by killing Soleimani in Baghdad is in part a message to North Korea that Trump has limited patience.
Interesting. So if we want to suppose that regime change may be the initiative by the Trump administration in Iran, is regime change also?
It seems to me an almost impossible dream. Korea has been divided into two countries. North Korea is very firmly held by Kim and his family and the authorities.
And they have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
That provides a certain amount of protection. Yeah.
So I don't think Trump was dreaming of regime change there. He was, again, vis-a-vis North Korea. Trump was dreaming of behavior change by suggesting that real estate developers could develop wonderful resorts on the North Korean beaches and it could be a prosperous country. I think that the very communist dictator Kim Jong-un wasn't interested in having beachside resorts.
One last point, if I may.
Please.
The differences between the United States and Korea today, after 3 years of his presidency, are exactly the same that they were in the very beginning. The United States is demanding that the North Koreans totally denuclearize, get rid of all of their nuclear weapons, their missiles that can carry them, their reactors, and only then will the United States lift sanctions. In other words, everything up front first.
Right.
And then we will do something. And the Koreans want, or North Koreans want, a more incremental process.
We're going to skip real quickly, and I wouldn't want to leave the show without talking about the hate crimes that have been perpetrated over the holidays in the United States. The New York City Police Department is increasing its police presence in some Brooklyn neighborhoods after the attacks during the Hanukkah holiday. There was a church shooting in Texas that took two lives. There's some connection between these two, and there's some very big differences between these two incidents. I'd like to give you both just a minute to talk
about
this.
Michael, I'm thinking that they're isolated incidents and that you have one crazy man with a rifle who went to that church in Texas and killed two men who were close to him, and then a third man who was on security duty for the congregation had a gun on him and in one incredibly accurate shot killed the attacker. And that's one incident, though I know what we're all feeling, that houses of worship are not holy places where you won't have violence. But we have a big country here with more than 300 million people, and that kind of thing will happen. I don't see a pattern there. When it comes to the attacks on Jews, especially visibly Orthodox Jews on the streets of New York City and that area, including the attack in a rabbi's house in Muncie, New York, well, that seems to be a wave of copycat attacks, of those Jews being attacked. The attackers seem to have great resentment for Jews and what they're doing in that area. And so there's a need for education, for more security, for more efforts at the Jewish and African American communities to try to have good leaders sit down together and achieve more understanding.
John, I'll give you the last word on this. And again, to Dan's point, is this more about the thing that's happening, or is it that maybe the political atmosphere being so charged is affecting how we are interpreting it, how we are feeling it?
I think that there is a wave of increased anti-Semitism in the United States, particularly since President Trump took office. Ever since his comments about Charlottesville, the white supremacist march in Charlottesville, where he said there were good people on both sides, these attacks have increased. It's almost as if his comments, the white supremacists felt that there was a green light from the president to express anti-Semitic feelings, and it has expressed itself in violence as well.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you very much to Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Newsweek, and Dan Raviv, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.